You are listening to Radio Albion.
Hello, this is Matthew Raphael Johnson. This is the Orthodox Nationalist on Radio Albion. Today's date is the 14th of June, 2026, and it's almost 2:30 in the morning, which is normally when I get these things done. This is part two, technically part three, of the, maybe even more than that, on the Slavophiles. I've done so many lectures on the Slavophiles here and elsewhere. I don't know what number this is, but for our purposes, it's two, because this is not just the Slavophiles. It's the Slavophile movement along with the reign of Nicholas I, under which they operated for the most part. Let me start off by quoting Nicholas here. He doesn't get quoted very much. He gets insulted beyond belief by the American, really, and European-American historical establishment. They are absolutely beyond unfair to him. And the irritation over that is one of the reasons I wrote The Third Rome in the first place. I learned something, though. You can't really write a book when you're angry. That's exactly what I did. But it turns out, at least the second edition of that book, it was the template for really the rest of my intellectual life. Because every aspect of that book I eventually did something on and will continue. It's an infinite supply of ideas and information. There's no way you could ever exhaust it. Let me quote Nicholas I here. This is from his testament near the end of his life. He's saying this to his children, to his family. Respect the law, and by your example teach others to respect it. If the law is broken by the Tsar, then it will not be obeyed by the ethnos, that is to say, the population. Spread education. The benefits of order and law are appreciated only by an educated people. Give heed to public opinion. It often enlightens us. It is a faithful ally and a stern judge of those who carry out its will. Love, freedom, and liberty. Because freedom stands for equity, and it connects the generosity of the Tsar with the nation. The Tsar's love for freedom strengthens the obedience of his subjects. Govern not by force, but by order. The true might of the Tsar lay not in the size of his armies, but in the prosperity of his people. Choose worthy and capable counselors. Pride blinds the Tsar and places him in the power of service courtiers, unmindful of his honor and the public good. Respect your people, and they will be worthy of respect. Love your nation, the ethnos. They will not love a Tsar if he does not love them. Be not disheartened by the world, but keep forever in your heart the vision of the beautiful and a belief in the good, which is also your faith in God. You will thus be saved from despising humanity, for to despise humanity is deadly for someone who is called on to reign. These are his last words, essentially, to his subjects, especially to his family, the future generations of Russian rulers. And there's so much here that fits into the topic of the Slavophile idea. Not so much the Slavophile idea, but the Slavophiles were faithful replicators of the Russian mind. There's a connection, first of all, of freedom with equity and justice. This is not negative freedom. This is actual liberty and autonomy to bring about just acts. It talks about the vision of the beautiful. In other words, that this is what you have to keep in mind, the truth Not fantasies, not your anger, not your passions. Govern by order rather than force. One of the most interesting lines of this whole thing. And I translated this, and I went back to the original 1,000 times over the years to make sure I had that right. And that's exactly what it is. Govern by order rather than force. To some extent, this is a matter of example. Talks about the nature of pride when it comes to picking your counselors. The connection of the czar to the land or to the nation. Now, if you were to get this this testament of Nicholas I and read it in a translation in any contemporary American or British publication, it will not say ethnos, it will not say nation, it'll just say people. As if he's referring to some abstraction out there. Ivan Ilin, when he talked about Hegel, it's the same thing. Hegel's talking about the nation over and over again. It doesn't get translated that way in English, though. But it should. It's dishonest. And finally, wanting to despise everybody. Marcus Aurelius mentions this once or twice, where you see the worst of humanity when you're the emperor. People who are obviously flattering you, people who are just terrified of you, people who are double-dealing, you know that they're not telling the truth. And you get exposed to that for a long time. You start to just loathe people. But it is a poisonous way to think. It's an easy poison to ingest, though. But again, the icon of the beautiful has to be in front of your mind at all times. The vision of what Russia truly is. Now, I could go on forever about this quote. When I first quoted it in that book many, many years ago as a young man, all these years later, I could tease out far more. I'm a very different man than I was in 2001 or 2002 when it came out. But connecting Tsar Nicholas to the Slavophiles is very easy. It doesn't seem obvious, but it's very easy. See, the classical idea of the Slavophile movement, you had to have heard last week to get this. The classical idea is that of Sobornost. Comes obviously from Sobor, the council, the synod. It's not the same thing as an actual literal council, though. It's similar to a council. It's a metaphor. Komiakov observed that St. Cyril Methodius, when they rendered the Greek word for Catholic, katholikos, they didn't say Veslensky, which would make more sense. It just means universal. You think Catholic means universal. No, they used Soborni. It's a very interesting choice that they used. Why? They don't think it's a coincidence. They invested the word with a meaning that's absolutely extraordinary for the future of the church. Komiakov's definition of Sobornost, Soborni is obviously its root. It's not characteristic of any historical epoch. It's not a social institution. But it is a superhistorical spiritual reality. In fact, he goes so far as to say that it's the primordial foundation of the entire world. Of course, the form it takes is ethnic, just because, the church does. St. Photios laid out the church on ethnic lines outside of the Byzantine Empire, even within it. So to rule properly, you have to rule within that subordinates, that same, essentially it's God's energies, another manifestation of God's energy. It is connected with grace, which is one and the same. Now, it's very obvious to say that, the bulk of the Slavophile movement existed during the reign of Tsar Nicholas I. Now, Tsar Nicholas is in this list of, you know, 20 or 30 people that are just insulted beyond belief by American historians. They hate him. They have to hate him. And it's unfair. It's childish. It's anti-intellectual, but they do it anyway. He was a good but not a great man. He was incorruptible. Although I don't know how you could corrupt somebody who has, you know, full power over people like that. His biggest problem was that he was a believer in the Petrine Revolution. But from a political point of view, remember, his historical sources that his tutors gave him all glorify the Tsars, you know, no matter who they were. Yeah, he was incorrect, but his intent was pure. He sought a holy and unified Russia, unable to be harmed by her many enemies. But what does that require? Discipline and love. Holy and unified Russia is the same thing as a disciplined and loving Russia. Again, get the old sappy idea of love out of your mind. That's not how they were using the term back then. But he also thought that the westernization of Peter had long run its course. He thinks that it was a needed aspect in Russian history. I disagree. But he is not this worshiper of Peter. He used that icon in his mind quite often, but it had its place. And now it needs to be overcome with a synthesis of both Moscow and Petersburg. The concept of Russian Orthodox civilization that can transcend both entities. You know, Russian Orthodox civilization had been achieved in Moscow. But it's not his fault. I mean, he didn't create the synod. He didn't create these institutions. He wasn't there in the middle of the 18th century. But he tried to make the best of it, at least intellectually. And he was a very well-educated man, as the Tsars all were in the 19th century. His conscience was sometimes overwhelming to him. He didn't want power. He felt the weight of not absolute power, but absolute responsibility that the throne placed upon him. You know, idiots in the classrooms will talk about the Russian Tsar was absolute, had absolute power. No. He asked Nicholas I, it means absolute responsibility. Everything is on my shoulders, and that means I am crushed with the weight. Marcus Aurelius said the same thing. The main connection between Nicholas and the Slavophile is that when Nicholas talked about the Orthodox conscience, the Christian conscience, you can't reduce anything like that to an institution. You can't reduce the Christian conscience to a synod. In theology, he completely rejected any kind of legal formalism. Love, which is the same thing as God's energy, binds the church together. It's the Holy Spirit, both in itself and as manifest in our acts. So both the Creator and that which is created. Grace, energy, same thing. It's the heritage of the entire church. And there you find freedom. There you find truth. But it's very difficult and very painful to do it. Now, opposing him was the Russian oligarchs, the landed wealthy, the powerful Jewish merchants, largely opposed to a nationalist royal government. You heard from that top quote that he's clearly an ethno-nationalist, and he was. This was a Russian empire, or at least an Eastern Slavic empire, because when you add Russians, Ukrainians, Belarusians, to the empire, that's, you know, 75%. But the oligarchs, wherever they go, believe that their personal wealth, their prestige, their power would be immensely increased if the royal family were limited or eliminated altogether. Oligarchy is what occurs when you do nothing. Our fallen nature will simply fall into oligarchy. Maintaining a virtuous society dedicated to the common good, it takes a lot of work, and it is not easy to maintain. and even someone with the powerful personality of Nicholas I or Alexander III couldn't do it all the time. And the truth is, the Russian royal state was the most limited in Europe. Enforcing laws was almost impossible over the expanses of Russian territory. But even if it could, it had little to do with the daily life of the peasant commune. There's no such thing as royal police in the countryside. And until Alexander II, until emancipation, there really was no presence of royal power outside of the governor level. Police powers in rural Russia, which is where most of the population lived, police powers there resided in the bargaining agreements between commune and landlord. Even the law enforcement agents at that level were elected by the commune. All levels of power were elected up to the governors of the large districts and, of course, the Tsar himself. But there was only one form of rebellion. Well, I don't want to go that far. There's two forms of rebellion against Russian monarchy. You see, I could talk about people like Pugachev and Rasin, but they were fighting, you know, foreigners. They were fighting heretical monarchs sitting on the Russian throne. So I don't even want to use them. So really, I can say there's only one rebellion against the monarch or monarchy as such. And that comes from the interests of the oligarchy, whether it be the high-level merchants, the landed estates. And it's often the case that these groups, in fact, it's always the case that these groups will count their personal needs and their personal desires, their corporate interests, in universal rhetoric. And they'll do that for the purposes of mobilization. One of the most famous is free trade. Free trade is abstract. It's universal. It sounds neutral, but it never is. Its true purpose is to enrich those oligarchs who are already trading with the West or whomever. The worst example of this, well, the worst example probably was the potato famine. But if you remember some years ago, I wrote a lengthy paper on the Opium Wars. The British invaded China and destroyed her institutions based on the rallying cry of free trade. I don't want to say the British so much as I want to say the East India Company under the Jewish Sassoon family. And the invasions, the Opium Wars, were done because the free trade principles were at stake. So, talking about the Razin or Blotnikov rebellions of the Petrine era, they were very ethno-nationalist. They were usually all believers. They pitted the traditionalist land against the urban and cosmopolitan oligarchs. That's one thing. But it's something altogether different, dealing with the existence of an abstract liberalism, abstract in the sense that it posits rights and duties that were not part of any lifestyle, that were simply castles in the air. Or at least they presented it that way. There was a specific agenda attached to it. But when rich people start talking about free trade, or when the Sassoon family, making millions, getting Chinese hooked on opium, when they start speaking of free trade once the Chinese said, we have had enough of this, well, obviously they're not talking about something in the abstract. That's how liberalism is. Freedom was always preached in the abstract. And when I say that, I mean, it's not freedom to do anything in particular. Rights always, the way they spoke, it always had an economic component that they didn't talk about very much in public. It was almost esoteric. The left spoke of freedom, but they said very little on how it should be used. So liberalism in Russia during the time of Nicholas I and afterwards was mostly the interest of the upper oligarchy demanding their share of power, mostly via the Masonic lodges. They demanded the destruction of traditional communal arrangements in the name of free trade out in the countryside so they can exploit free labor. Rather than having to go through layers of peasant authority to get to the individual, They wanted to dominate what had heretofore been a fairly free and prosperous peasantry. Left alone, governed by very traditional structures of power and bargaining. Like all great monarchs, Nicholas knew this, and he was at war with them. And he also made sure, something else that the literature doesn't understand, he made war against the oligarchs, not the aristocrats. They're mirror images of each other. Liberalism comes from oligarchy, not aristocracy. Liberalism came from the ranks of oligarchy because it served their interests. But that also means that Freemasonry grew rapidly among them, and their salons, and their basements, and wherever else. You see, what the left will never understand is that laws do not create consensus. Laws presuppose consensus. And in my opinion, that's a very profound statement. Laws that create consensus have to use force. Laws that presuppose it are truly representative. This is at the root of Hegelianism, in my opinion. I had a few questions from people, comments, very good ones. They're from supporters. The connection of Hegel to orthodoxy and Ivan Ilin's two-volume work is significant. And just for now, let me say to them, I don't go to Hegel for theology. I never have. You know, when it comes to philosophy, I use whoever I need to use. There's profundity in everybody. Hegel, when it comes to political science, I think the philosophy of right is the greatest work of political philosophy ever written. Unfortunately, you have to kind of know the Hegelian system before you can read it. And the Hegelian system is incomprehensible, and at least in certain areas. But hey, you have me. Let me repeat myself. Laws do not create consensus. They presuppose consensus. But while Nicholas I ruled, there was this concerted drive to destroy the commune, to destroy peasant governance and their traditional checks and balances on other power centers in the area. The point was to isolate the peasant as an individual. That's what individual liberty meant in this context. And if you can reduce the commune to a group of atomized individuals and the Jews remain extremely ethnocentric, then who wins? Because numbers don't matter. Cohesiveness matters. Once the peasant or the artel worker in the city was removed from the commune and the communal structures ultimately protected and empowered by the Tsar, the poor soul is now at the mercy of multimillionaires. And they're standing naked in front of them. Frankly, the commune did have substantial juridical power. And on a daily basis, it really was the only authority that peasants dealt with on a daily basis. To destroy those traditional arrangements by destroying royal power was, therefore, the primary goal of these people. And this will soon show itself in the Decembrist Revolt, and even after it was put down, it just went underground into its lodges. Now, Alexander I died, I put that in quotes, died November 19th, 1825. Actually, he became a monk in secret, but either way, he died at least to the political order. Back in April, I did a lecture on the Decembrists, and so I don't have to go through this in great detail, but when Alexander I died, there was some confusion as to the succession. See, by normal procedure, it would have gone to Constantine's, which was Alexander's oldest brother. However, Constantine's libido got the best of him, and he found himself in sexual thrall to a Polish aristocratic salon woman, who made him renounce the throne, because if he took it, he'd have to dump her. Well, thank God for it, because the throne went to a brilliant, motivated, and energetic man, Nicholas I. Alexander had confirmed the succession to him in his own writing shortly before his death. It was made clear. But unfortunately, Nicholas hadn't seen that. And when Alexander retired to the monastic life, his death, quote-unquote, Nicholas, not having seen this, just swore allegiance to Constantine. But even when he did see it, he still insisted that Constantine, following proper order, be ruler of Russia. But Constantine was busy. But finally, Nicholas gave in. No one in the English language literature at all even provides a stray comment about how extraordinary Nicholas's behavior was here. I thought everyone wanted power. I thought this is what people wanted. He could have easily taken the throne right after Alexander's death. But no, given proper procedure, he insisted to go to his elder brother. Therefore, he starts off his reign. It's not about his own self-interest, unlike his brother's interest in his, his new hobby. He was a model monarch in many ways. He was selfless and very disciplined. But there was confusion here. The lodges began to realize that they had a unique situation. Normally, the esoteria of the secret cults is the famous Masonic slogan, Ordo ab Chaos, order out of chaos. Now, chaos is very important. Chaos and confusion are necessary to bring about social change because people are more suggestible in that state of agitation than it would be in a state of peace. Revolutionaries of the next generation, using terror, bombings, and everything else, they're well aware of that fact. Because of the confusion, even the army itself was kind of paralyzed. They didn't know which way to go. So the occults decided to stage rebellion and bring the Jacobin Revolution to Russia. And they did it, as they always do, through lies and manipulation. All for our own good, of course. Most they did is convince a few regiments that there was no such manifesto giving the throne to Nicholas, and Constantine was a true czar. And what's cynical about the whole thing is that the Jacobins were using the soldiers' loyalty to czardom to stage the Republican Revolution. Still, the soldiers who were talked to this way, supporting the Masonic conspiracy, were very confused. Once they reached the Senate Square, they refused to fight. Nicholas was aware of these difficulties and refused as well to use any kind of force. So he did what any normal person would do. He sent the Governor General of Petersburg to speak to the rebels and get them to reconsider. Well, what did they do? They shot him in the back for no clear reason as he's walking away. People like Ryzhanovsky, the famous historian, that's left out of his account. After an entire day of a standoff, Nicholas, unfortunately and reluctantly, brought out the cannon and the murderers were dispersed. A few hundred were arrested, but the overwhelming majority were soon released. Most of those people were simple soldiers who were lied to by the Masonic conspiracy. That was the December's Rebellion. So, because of Nicholas's insistence on royal tradition over Jacobin oligarchy and ideology, he receives the most biased and unfair treatment by historians. There's no support for Nicholas anywhere in English, except for people like me. That's the tight noose in academic writing in the field. But he was the most autocratic, orthodox, and traditional of the monarchs who were the best leaders and the greatest reformers. And there's one important reason for this. A monarch must be strong enough to be able to say no to all centers of power that exist in any society. Only then can he fairly adjudicate disputes from each estate or class. It's not bias or pressure. But then he can actually be autonomous. He can make decisions from the interests of national, state unity and stability. That's hard to do, but Nicholas did it. And it is a difficult and thankless and lonely job. Without that, he's not a monarch at all. And he did it very well, though. He was an excellent monarch. He was stern but fair, harsh on leftist revolutionaries, but, as he proved in the aftermath of the revolt, he was very merciful. Maybe too merciful. Rezhonovsky, you know, the dean of the establishment historians in these days, he claims with some justification that Nicholas preferred to go outside of the normal state channels to run the state machinery, which is a very good thing. He would use ad hoc committees and meetings to put forth his agenda. The normal channels, I mean, you know, Senate, body of appointed ministers, he rendered them more or less unimportant. And it shows an important thing. Regardless of Nicholas's admiration for Peter I, he, like his grandson, did not trust the increasing centralization and regularization of state and society, which is a classic Slavophilic concept. He knew that these kind of elite bureaucratic devices were a major means of undermining autocratic authority in favor of the new bourgeois and careerist civil servants. He simply bypassed those channels. So he created things like His Majesty's Own Chancery, something he invented to bypass the normal institutions. He could actually get things done that way. But because of the Decembrists, he also had to increase levels of police power, at least in the city. And that's where the third department of His Own Chancery came from. I mean, since at least Tsar Basil III, in the Middle Ages, the perennial worry was that it was the oligarchy. That's where revolution was being hatched. Workers or peasants, they had to be forced to go on strike. But the oligarchs were a different story. Authors, stupid authors, they rail against Nicholas's attack on the Russian people, when by people, they really mean the upper oligarchy and the merchants. Those who were actually plotting against Nicholas, his predecessors and his successors. Nicholas, because of this power that he had, thus being able to be an actually free man, the American politicians, British politicians, none of them are free. They're told what to do. You can't run a campaign for 5 seconds without media support, without money. Tsars didn't have to worry about this stuff. They were powerful enough. This is why military governments often are very effective, at least in the short term. They didn't have to listen to the wealthy. In fact, they hated the wealthy. His major victories as Tsar came from this very position. He made major improvements in the life of state peasants. He freed peasants belonging to the state as well as peasants belonging to the actual royal family. He revised the Russian Law Code, 1838, and that's when the state peasants were given full self-government. Now, that reform of Nicholas concerning state peasants was the very model that Alexander II would use for his emancipation of all private peasants. But I haven't seen that in literature anywhere, except in Russian. Local level of state peasant organization was very important. Nicholas wanted to see the commune transformed into a communal village. Actually, empower that even more than it already had been. The village, with delegations consisting of 2 people for every 10 households, were to elect a starshina, an elder, as well as set up a local court system, chaired by the very same elder with 2 other judges elected by the communal assembly. Those rural communes then combined into a township, maybe 6,000 heads of households. A mayor would be elected that is answerable to the communes. Above him would be the district or the county. That was led by a superintendent, and then his powers were all a bit varied depending on the region and the provincial level. And that was appointed by the Tsar and answerable only to him. He stopped many of the worst abuses of serfdom, like separating families. Now, serfdom is not what you think it is. I've dealt with this many times before. But separating families was against the law. But given the inability of the Tsardom to reach the countryside, these laws remained, you know, formalities, unfortunately. Under Nicholas, the method for deciding levels of taxation was shifted from people, which was a modern invention from Peter the Great, to the land, which is closer to the Russian tradition. Wesenowski writes, and actually it's not a great, but it's a good book. Nicholas I, An Official Nationality in Russia, 1825-1855. I read that a lot when I was writing my first book. He says this. Furthermore, throughout his life, Nicholas I was bent on improving himself morally and spiritually. And while one may question the results of his efforts, there is no reason to doubt his sincerity. And further, Nicholas I, the famous Sergei Uvarov, his Minister of Education, Mikhail Pogodin, Nikolai Shevrev, Gogol, and even Fyodor Bulgarin, as well as many others, all wanted to educate their fellow countrymen morally and spiritually and to make them good Christians and perfect Russians. The main means for achievement of this purpose were the family and the school. It's on page 91. It's not a bad book. But to the left wing, that was an enormous problem. It's under Nicholas I where official nationality was developed. The famous phrase, orthodoxy, autocracy, nationality is what we're talking about here. That was a serious organizing principle. It was an attempt to do what modern political science says cannot be done, uplift the moral basis of the citizenry. It was a means to unify the country, and as always, it had many enemies, and it had many areas of vulnerability, as the wars in Crimea and Port Arthur, etc., were to show later. It has been charged by those like Wesenowski and Hoskins, many others, that religion, that is, the Russian Orthodox Church, did very little. They did very little more than preach obedience to the Tsar. That's a very common, cynical slogan. So the massive amount of ascetic literature churchmen were producing at this time goes unnoticed by people who are supposed to be Russia scholars. Although, you know, even if they did preach obedience to the Tsar, if this is a problem, why would it be such a problem to the self-appointed preachers of liberty? The Tsar was Orthodox. He subsidized the church. He subsidized missionary efforts throughout the empire and beyond it. He was personally pious, and he was just in dealing with people. He insisted on the primacy of the Russian tradition. He didn't create the synodal system. So why should he be opposed? But the leftists who dominate Russian historiography in America, they despise the church loyalty to the Tsar. That's an old, you know, multi-generational Jewish thing. But they realize what Harrison realized before them, that the union between Tsar and church meant that the system was reinforced and maintained by the loyalty of the massive majority of Russian population, and in most respects. In other words, the church acting in concert with the Christian Tsar meant that the system was that much more reinforced and insulated from their well-subsidized propaganda. Autocracy. That's very important for a few reasons, one of which is that the Jacobins, jumping at the bit to plunge Russia into their own French terror, knew that the only real force acting against them, that had any real coercive power, was the monarchy. Whether it be France in 1780, Austria in 1848, Germany in 1918, the extreme left in politics, romanticized by the hallucinogenic radicals in American universities, knew that once the monarchy was gone, the society would not last long, and it wouldn't have the focus and unity necessary to resist them. No matter what else, the Masonic revolutionaries, Jewish cohesiveness, and whatever country they were found in this era had one thing in mind: destroy the monarchy and those loyal to it. The great Nikolai Gogol, the famous Russian writer, Russo-Ukrainian writer, my favorite writer, a true believer in official nationality. This is what he said about the necessity of autocracy in Russia. Why is it necessary that one of us should require a position above all others and even above the law? Because the law is wooden. Man feels that law contains something harsh and unbrotherly. One will not get far with merely a letter of perfect execution of the law. But none of us should break the law or fail to comply with it. This is why we need some supreme grace to mitigate it, as it can come to men only in the form of absolute power. A state without an absolute monarch is an automaton. And I love that quote, but it does need some interpretation. Now, Rysanowski quotes it, and he moves on. He doesn't mention it again. From his point of view, such a passing mention of Gogol's opinion makes some sense. It refutes the smug and unargued assumptions of liberal democracy, liberal or socialist. This, of course, is required of all academics. But within that famous quote, the equally famous writer, come the arguments and justification for the autocratic state. The first sentence. In liberal democracies, those who have the most ambition to rule are those who run for office. Nicholas showed the opposite, that even when the crown was handed to him, he rejected it. Only under pressure did he accept the crown. In democratic thinking, only the ambitious and obnoxious are capable of doing what's necessary to get elected or to take power. And politicians are whores. Everyone knows this. They're forced to alter their views depending on the group they're meeting, speaking to at the moment. He's constantly asking for money, especially if he's in the House of Representatives, with far less grace than a common prostitute. He's usually pretty ignorant about the basic principles of political philosophy, including the philosophy that informs his own government. They have to constantly campaign. They're elected every 2 years, so they don't have time to reflect, reason, and prove himself. In postmodern oligarchies, it's usually the case that the only social interaction of significance occurs within the court system, which is very expensive and slow. It is certainly harsh and unbrotherly, because the system, instead of insisting that personal disputes be solved by private and traditional authorities like the church, demands that it be brought before itself, the supreme judge of all private affairs. High-priced lawyers, for those who can afford them, large concentrations of capital, with a handful of well-publicized exceptions, they can easily dominate the courtroom through their armies of counsel. The law is words on paper. Language changes, meaning changes. What was meant in 1790 is not what the average American thinks it means today. The average American doesn't ever even heard of Shays' Rebellion. But when the American War of Independence was over, there were rebellions in Pennsylvania and Massachusetts, large ones, substantial ones, so great that George Washington had to come out of retirement sometime later. The country rose up against the new regime that had taken over in, Philadelphia or New York. The anti-federalists represented that group of people. People believe the history they want to believe. But let's drop that for now. Philosophically, again, I want to talk about Hegel in this regard. I've been asked about it. Now, I wrote this many years ago. The notion of counter-revolutionary nationalism moves from the well-known Hegelian logical scheme, abstract unity, A, specific content, B, the full unity, the content and unity together in one fully explicated whole, C. Hegel never used thesis, antithesis, etc., since he never said that once in his life. But abstract unity, specific content, and the full unit, well, he did say that, or a version thereof. Let's put it like this. Any object, anything, say something like justice. Well, let's say something even simpler. Let's say a man. Any object can be considered first as a unity. A man is just a man. A singular object in space encasing many functions. But secondly, he could be considered as his content, that is, those functions, reasoning, breathing, creating, working, proving, whatever it is. So either he's seen as a unified man or as a set of things. Now, over time, Those two things are always altering each other. The mind is restless. The mind has to find a foundation, something even more foundational than those two. A third thing. They lead the mind almost necessarily to the synthetic unity, the final idea of man or anything, as a complex unity. A man can be considered as a full unity, synthetic unity, both as a singular entity that is vivified by many internal functions, the full interrelation of both form and function developing together. There is unity, that which is unified, the content, and the fully explicated object, the synthesis of those two. So in politics, it might look like this. Number one, counter-revolutionary nationalism begins with abstract unity, natural law theory, the very grounding of collective life in God's energies. Without it, social life is just arbitrary. It's a unity of force and habit. There's no identity, there's no morality. That's the static entity. That's the static nature of man's mind. It's not subject to development. Now, it doesn't exhaust man as a social creature. Man is irrational, and man is communal or irreducible conceptions. To deny these ingredients of being human, you have to utilize them. So for someone to deny that mankind is communal, you have to use language, logic, and a common frame of reference, all of which derives from a specific community. So if you were to deny that man is rational, use another example, you have to use rational arguments to make that point. Either way, a contradiction is reached. So one might conclude with certainty that man is essentially communal and rational, that these ideas are eternal and natural, not subject to modification at their root. The notion of man as rational and man as communal, no doubt highly related notions, contain ethical precepts that has to be followed if humanity is to be rational at all. If this is to happen, then man is moral. Natural law shows that mankind is possessed by its own nature of objective ethical truths that cannot be violated without logical contradiction and necessarily social destruction. But natural law, as important as it is, that's just the foundation, that's just the abstract condition for speaking intelligibly about social ethics. It's an abstract unity, it's a frame of social life. Yeah, mankind is a communal animal, which by its idea's very nature means that all mankind enjoys from society is also natural to him, to paraphrase Edmund Burke. Education, labor, family life, government, the state, moral restraint, aesthetic and intellectual activity, personal leisure, enjoyment, friendship, are all things inconceivable outside of a community. None of these things are possible without a common language, frame of reference, or a common basic morality, and implicit norms of behavior that make up this massive complex of cultural community, i.e. the ethnos. But none of those are possible without a force, some version of the state, usually a monarchy of some kind, that protects the achievements of one's life from theft or destruction. Without community, mankind simply can't exist. Okay, that's the first thing. Now, here's the second. I'm trying to be Hegelian about this. From this understanding, one is immediately led by the nature of the concept itself to think about its content. Natural law, in and of itself, doesn't have much content. It's too abstract. It's like Kant's conception of moral freedom. Once you start thinking about the nature of the association found in natural law, that's mandated by the very concept of being a human being, well, then you have to talk about what that natural unity is. Start talking about nations, the cultural community. See, natural law is general. It functions as a foundation for moral judgment. But it doesn't do more than that. National life is a content. It contains specific precepts that are, in order to be just and ethical, reducible to natural law. But it all depends on many other aspects. Natural law is necessary to check the national idea. And of course, natural law is completed by the divine law. They ask the question, what is the nature of our association that is so mandated by nature through the idea of being a human being? That is to say, that a human being, considered as such, has ethical requirements. So natural law is merely the external unity of human association. The internal unity, its content, I mean, any unity has to be a unity of something, is a cultural unity of the community, the nation. And it has to be a nation because you have to be unified in language and culture and moral norms, or you can't function. So what natural law mandates, the specific needs of a man are met by the formation of actual societies, things that develop over time. Government, economics, family life, that develops their own internal functioning in reference to the proto-nation and the forces that create it, or that manifest it. So, yeah, these institutions are natural to mankind, and they refer to man's static essence. Their specific content is a product of social development. There, man is a dynamic creature. Now, this is the central notion of tradition found only in the ethnic whole. Don't talk to me about tradition or community without ethnicity. The means of evaluation, whether something is done well or poorly within a society, you can't discern that unless you're talking about the internal functioning of the various practices and occupations and customs that have come to develop in any specific society. This is a content. So the unity that natural law posits, this ethical foundation, that gets broken down into its most general components. But both are abstract. The form and the content are both out there. They're incomplete. They provide only a one-sided view of society. So natural law, on the one hand, is too general to develop any notion of determinate moral rules, though it forms the basis for evaluating rules that have developed over time. On the other hand, the rule of custom and social practice, without the control of objective moral criteria, can lead to a static despotism. Human custom itself can be perverted and used for cynical ends. Custom, community, nationality, on which it is based, become arbitrary when removed from objective moral criteria, which, of course, you know, is based on God's creator. Thus alone, neither natural law nor the communal custom, the nation, are competent to fully explicate our social life, though they're both necessary to it. Now, how does it resolve itself? Number three. The above two movements, natural law and the development of communal consciousness, passed over to their synthesis, internal distributive justice. The continued interplay between natural law ethics and the development of communal organization, specifically as it affects the lives of individuals and families, or families and communities, as I should say. In other words, it's national socialism. Nationalists must never ignore the internal distribution of rewards within a national organization. We talk about national and communal solidarity, but doesn't that suggest a more egalitarian distribution of political power and income? Is nationalism necessarily egalitarian, sort of, given the central nationalist idea of social cohesion and solidarity? Well, if the answer is no, there's a problem. It's just a method of papering over arbitrary power. But if yes, then any nationalism must also be social. It's a contradiction to claim the centrality or vital importance of national solidarity on the one hand, while accepting radical differentiations in power and prestige based on wealth on the other. In other words, national solidarity would seem to necessarily engender self-sacrifice, shared work, communal economic organization, and a rejection of the capitalist ethos that rejects any notion of nationality or solidarity in any way. Nationalism is a coherent and interesting theory of social organization or solidarity that comes from Hegel and Herder. Cannot ignore the idea of internal distribution of wealth and power. It could be a monarchy, but even in old Russia, every layer of power was elected. It can't fall into the trap of talking about external things, you know, sovereignty, race realism, cultural community, while ignoring internal realities like the distribution of income, wealth, prestige, or social standing. So distributive justice is a synthesis of natural law and communal organization. It's national socialism. Nowhere else is this more relevant. Now, this was written, remember, I initially wrote this in 2001. And so I could easily at the time say, well, this is very relevant in Russia, where the overwhelming majority of the wealth was concentrated in oligarchic hands, Jewish hands, and or fled the country altogether. So on the one hand, natural law natural law claims that all individuals enjoy a part of the community to become natural to him. On the other hand, the communal ethos is never merely to benefit a certain class at the expense of all others. That contradicts the very notion of communal solidarity. Therefore, the notion of distributive justice must be taken more seriously. Now, leftists, in one form or another, usually maintain the final decision, the decision-making power of distribution of goods and services is in the hands of the state. Well, controlled by the right people, of course. It's a formal arrangement of abstract economics, political theory, and social policy. But on the other hand, nationalist theory seeks a distribution of rewards based on the very tradition of the society in question. Now we're talking about basing rewards on socially identifiable and useful practices, occupations, trades, and professions that have been around forever. Not to mention the life of the church, also connected with man's nature, and it becomes an essential part of it. I wrote that a long time ago. I've updated it. I've added sections. But that semi-Hegelian A, B, and C was the very heart, and is the very heart of my understanding of nationalism. It comes straight out of both the mentality of Nicholas I, as well as Hegel and the Slavophile. Now, the Slavophiles were not necessarily Hegelians, or they were Hegelians of an eccentric sort. They had their own problems with Nicholas, but they were most certainly ethno-nationalists. The nation, not the formal state, in their minds, was the organic reality. Legal formalism is needed only in relations between conquerors and conquered, but unnecessary when state power is organic and popular in origin. Slavophiles completely reject the mechanics of numbers, the principles of majority vote, or that public truth can be born from arithmetic calculation. I mean, a nation can't rule. The people can't rule. It's an absurdity. The people is an abstraction by itself. Abstractions can't rule. And we don't want it to. It's relevant to say that the Slavophiles also had a huge aversion to bureaucracy, partially because it separated the nation from the Tsar, its true ruler. Bureaucracy is not organic. It's alien to the Russian spirit. I think it's alien to any spirit. Well, he says it's borrowed from the Germans, but he says it's a disease of Russian life. But in my opinion, it developed only when foreigners took over the state after 1918. But a sense of high calling, of popular origin, that's alien to the bureaucratic mind. Remember, power is an obligation, it's a duty, it's a burden, it's a feat. It's not a right. Slavophiles are opponents of bureaucratic monarchism and imperialism, which is pretty similar to Western absolutism. They're also supporters of a popular, uniquely Russian royalism, which has nothing in common with bureaucracy. But even at the height of the Petersburg system, the Russian bureaucratic class was a fraction per 100,000 population, as it was in Germany, France, or Britain. Russian bureaucracy was tiny by comparison, and I mean that per 100,000, not absolutely, of course. Autocracy is not the same as absolutism. The entire essence of Peter's great reform came down to one thing: the replacement of Russian autocracy with absolutism. Autocracy just meant royal rule, but it became, with Peter, in the Komiakov would say, the Romano-German Empire, like the rest of Europe. Within the boundaries of popular understanding, the Tsar is sovereign, but his sovereignty has nothing in common with absolutism in the Western type. Komiakov, like all Slavophiles, he saw society as an organism, never a mechanism. Social sciences today have to view society entirely as a mechanism. Economists have to view it that way. Sobornost, if you want to use the word conciliarity, there is organic social conciliarity that's very different from collectivism, behind which ecclesiastical sobornost is concealed. Only an Orthodox society is organic in the true sense of the word. A society that has lost faith disintegrates, and it turns into a mechanism of interests and parties clashing, very much like Weimar Germany or the U.S. today. Kolmogorov, and I think any healthy person, understands society in terms of the family, since the family is a primordial unit of society. Family relations are the ideal prototypes of all social relations. All social relations are built on the model of the relationship between the children and the father, especially. The Tsar relates to his people as the father relates to his children. Paul Witz was a man who, I think the book was called Faith of Our Fathers, where he proved in no uncertain terms, endless statistics, that those who do not have a father or a strong father figure do not believe in God, generally speaking. They also certainly want nothing to do with a czar or a monarch. Father on earth, czar, father in heaven. It's all one vertical thing. If you don't experience the father on earth, the rest of it doesn't make any sense. When the father is not present, everything goes to hell. When the father is not present, there is not a single, and of course the social science literature on this can fill an airplane hangar. There's not a single form of social pathology that a kid enters into that is not caused by lack of a father figure, including homosexuality. Knowing that, the left continues that policy. Now, in Rush's case, the Tsar is a negation of absolutism. He's bound by the limits of the national understanding and worldview. It serves as a framework within which power can and should be itself free. He's limited in the same way as a father's limited. I raised two boys, two credits to the society. Was I unlimited in my power? No, of course not. Did I spank my kids? I most certainly did. But you're not supposed to ever do it in anger. You don't spank your kids to make you feel better. It's to correct behavior. Of course, we have all done the wrong thing in that regard, but, you know, that was about it. We are very strictly limited. I don't need the state. I don't need legality to tell me that certain things are wrong. Autocracy has always considered itself limited. Only conditionally, or maybe only during wartime, like the Cossack Hetman. These limitations live in the people and the church. I don't care how powerful a leader is. He has to take many power centers into account before acting. Unlimited royal power is a myth that exists on paper. Now, today, maybe financial power being unlimited, that's not a myth. But talking about the absolute power of the Tsar, certainly it, or any monarchy. Autocracy in the Russian sense is not imperialism, it's not bureaucracy, it's not absolutism, it's not a cult of personality. Autocracy is immediately linked to the spirit of the ethnos. God's truth, not man's. Slavophile autocracy has nothing in common with what happened with Peter the Great in Petersburg. And this is, you know, Nikolai Berdyaev talking. Russian nation don't recognize power as such. They recognize it only as a moral calling. It's authority, not power. When power sees itself as a right and a privilege, and the nation begins to feel it as external or alien to them, as coercive and violent, then that power cannot last. The inclination towards absolutism, towards Western-style imperialism, began at the time of Peter the Great and triumphs in St. Petersburg, that bureaucratic era. Konstantin Aksakov, one of the great later Slavophile, held that the state should possess the fullness of power and action, especially in foreign affairs, while local institutions should possess the fullness of opinion, thought, freedom, and spiritual life. The Slavophiles, to a man, attributed bureaucracy and absolutism to Peter the Great in the St. Petersburg period of Russian history is a betrayal of true Russia, of old Russia. But maybe it's lasted for too long. Maybe it's gone too deep. The Slavophiles protested against the historical reality of Petersburg in the name of Orthodoxy. It saw Orthodoxy as an attainable ideal, truly Russian principles. The Petersburg period was disconnected from popular life. This inclination towards imperialism, absolutism, and bureaucracy, that is the triumph of mechanism over organism, and is totally illegitimate, not just from the Slavophile point of view, but from any rational point of view. The Slavophiles mostly rode in the realm of either of Alexander II or Nicholas I. They were not in opposition either. They had problems, but they were not in opposition to either one. But they were royalists of the pre-Petrine sort, like yours truly is. But Western theorists don't have the conceptual capacity, they don't have the mental tools to analyze these men. Subordinost is beyond them. It's inconceivable to the Western mind. It's difficult to define if it hasn't been experienced, as I've experienced it. Again, I mentioned St. George, my experience there before. It's too late to get into it now. I've mentioned it many times in the past. But this is the opposite of analytic philosophy and the vulgar and simplistic belief in logical rigor. Sometimes they claim they're just Hegelians, which is somewhat closer, but they haven't studied Hegel either. Civilization, which is a decayed form of culture, demands mechanization, bureaucratization, a fall legality, resting on the former so as to justify and protect the interests of those who have the power to erect and administer such a structure. Hegel and Herder certainly were important factors in Slavophilism and the understanding of monarchy. Hegel was a monarchist. But so too were the ancient patristic ideas on unity. They're normally not amenable to today's academic understanding, so they're pretty much ignored and labeled as I've said before, in my first book, Prosholie and Proshul, the past is not in the past. It remains with us always. Thank you very much for listening. That's the end of part two. That's the end of the topic. I'll talk to you again with a new topic next week. Bye-bye.